Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We are on a reduced schedule today for a variety of reasons, so we want to move through our agenda as quickly as we can. Just to notify the audience, the Senate Bill 297 and Senate Bill 305 do not yet have all the necessary paperwork, so those will not be moved out of committee this session, although we will take up an amendment to 305. And so we will start today by opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 322.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Senate Bill 322, it pertains to the multifamily housing tax exemption that may be received by taxpayers that own a building that is used for the multifamily use. And it adds the publicly beneficial elements of a structure, possibly including any commercial uses, to the list of parts of property that can be receiving this tax exemption. These elements may be required by the county or city in order to receive the exemption.
Okay, let's start off with Commissioner Nick Fish, County Chair Jeff Kogan, and Kate Allen.
Good afternoon. I apologize, I'm a little under the weather, but I will try to enunciate. Good afternoon, members of the Senate Revenue Committee. My name is Nick Fish, and I have the great honor of serving as the Housing Commissioner for the City of Portland. As the Housing Commissioner, I oversee the Portland Housing Bureau, which currently administers all of our residential property tax exemption programs and issues annual reports. Before I begin, I want to thank you for your work in the 2010 session to support the program by passing Senate Bill 1015A, which clarified the scope of the program for existing exemption holders. Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Morse, and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to briefly testify today in support of Senate Bill 322. SB 322 extends the sunset date of the Multiple Housing Unit Exemption Program to 2022 and includes language that clarifies that the commercial portion of the housing structure can, under certain circumstances, also be exempt, so long as it provides a clear public benefit specified by the city or the county. This bill completes the administrative cleanup by establishing the authority of local governments to design and implement programs that strategically meet local housing and community development goals. The exemption program provides a strategic, limited-term investment by local governments, and it leverages private equity and conventional debt. At a time of declining public resources, it is a vitally important tool in our toolkit to address the unmet housing needs of our people. I'm honored to be here today with my friend and colleague, Chair Jeff Kogan, and Kate Allen, who's the city's housing policy manager. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the Senate Revenue Committee. My name is Jeff Kogan. I'm the chair of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners, and I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 322. I would like to be supportive of everything that Commissioner Fish just said, and I also wanted to just highlight some of the coordinated work that the City of Portland and Multnomah County are undertaking in order to continue to be good stewards of the tax exemption program. The City and the County are continuing to work together cross-jurisdictionally, and we have a technical staff working group that really is an important part of this collaboration on a technical basis, the people who are actually in the field working in the programs on a day-to-day basis. Commissioner Fish and I are co-chairing what we call the Big Look Policy Committee, which is a group of elected officials, community members, who are working together to evaluate the goals and the effectiveness of the various residential tax abatement programs in order to guide their future direction in our community. The outcome of this work will consider program changes that balance shared housing goals and the stewardship of property tax revenue. and the extension of the multiple unit housing exemption that is part of Senate Bill 322 will enable our work at the city and the county to continue and to continue to improve our community. So thank you very much, and I would encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Kate Allen. I'm the housing policy manager with the City of Portland, working closely with Commissioner Fish's office and with our colleagues at the county. I'm going to really quickly give you a couple of the details about what Senate Bill 322 does for us. The new multiple unit housing and transit-oriented development programs that the that Portland operates under the statutory authority of ORS 307-600 through 637, which relates to multiple unit housing, provide an incentive for the construction of new higher density mixed income housing near transit facilities such as the MAX light rail system and in centers and corridors designated by Metro's 2040 growth concept. In 2010-11, the exemptions benefited a total of 3,103 units citywide and represent an investment by all taxing jurisdictions, that is, of foregone revenue, of $3,900,000. The current authority sunsets in 2012. An extension of the multi-unit housing exemption for 10 years signals to the finance and development community that the jurisdictions are supportive of certain types of higher density transit proximate mixed income housing to increase housing opportunities in locations that are consistent with goals set forth at the federal level through the HUD Sustainable Communities Initiative, Portland Plan goals, and our regional growth strategy. The exemptions currently serve a total of 3,000 housing units. 2,900 of those approximately are rental units, and about 160 are owned units. Of those, about 1,200 serve households with incomes less than 60% of median. That would be 42,000 approximately for a four-person family. About 109 of those are restricted to what we'd call workforce housing at less than 80% of median, about 56,000 a year for a family of four, and about 1,600 of the units are unrestricted rents. We're accomplishing other goals with the program, such as transit proximate and highest density. The commercial improvements in these projects, also exempted, many of these that you heard about last year, include neighborhood serving local businesses such as an H&R Block, salons, childcare, a Rite Aid, cafe coffee shops, groceries, and other local retail. In these locations, the city zoning code requires ground floor commercial improvements. And both for-profit and non-profit developers have used this particular exemption. The exemption leverages private investment in the form of developer equity and conventional financing. Applicants are required to demonstrate that the exemption is necessary for the financial feasibility of the project. They pass a developer's rate of return test so that that is not excessive, and assure the provision of sufficient public benefit beyond location efficiency. Current public benefits I mentioned before, but include affordable housing and other neighborhood serving. For some developments, additional public subsidy is required, such as tax increment financing. The exemption, as I said, is an incentive for the development community to develop the kind of residential improvements we want, that is, to unit mix and levels of affordability, where we want them, and leverages private investment. And without the incentive, these developments may not happen or may not include affordability or other public benefits that are financially feasible because the exemption is used. Finally, specific to the commercial portion, the commercial provision is consistent with the way the program has been run in the past and with the 2010 legislative action to grandfather exempted properties. It essentially clears the cloud, finishes our housekeeping that was created with a letter from the Attorney General that recommended that we clear the cloud so that local goals for types of public benefits to be included in residential developments can be considered. Finally, the legislation gives local decision makers, through the Big Look process, as Chair Kogan mentioned, clear statutory authority to design the program together to meet joint goals. The public benefits that qualify for exemption will be determined by the jurisdictional partners out of the Big Look process. Thanks.
Thank you. And I don't see your testimony up here, but you do have copies.
We turned it in. Yes.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Haas.
Thank you. I'm supportive. I just wonder if you have data or evidence where this would not have happened, this project would not have happened without this exemption. Or is, I mean, are we really incenting behavior with this? And this, you know, from a committee that a few years ago we gave out tax credits to people who bought hybrids, only to find out that there were waiting lists at every Toyota dealership for people to buy them anyway, most of whom had no idea that they were going to get a tax credit.
Senator Haas, it's a great question. I'll give you two answers. The first is that we do a very rigorous audit every year to make sure that everyone who participates in the program continues to be eligible, and we kick people off who aren't. So we've been maintaining some accountability with the public and how we administer the program. But in terms of the front-end question, the great majority of the housing we're talking about is but-for housing. And you'll hear from Jill Sherman in a moment, but for a tax abatement and some public subsidy, it would not be built to the specifications that we seek. We have an enormous deficit in our community of housing for people that have either no income or up to about 30% of median family income. So people that are really hard hit in this recession. Over 15,000 people are not being met by the market. This is a tool that allows us to leverage the kind of housing that meets their needs. And the vast majority of the housing would not be built in the manner that we're seeking, targeted to the people that we need to seek in the neighborhoods without this incentive. And we'd be happy to supply you with a copy of our last annual report that actually documents some of this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Kelburn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of an open question. I don't care if you all answer or one. You know, I come from an area where a couple of years ago nothing was affordable. Now everything's affordable. So we don't have an affordable housing problem anymore. So my question to you is this going to just put more additional units, flood the market, so to speak, more additional units competing for people, or is this really still addressing a need that is unmet with the current affordable housing that's been realized in the last couple of years?
Senator Telfer, it's the latter.
Okay.
On any given night in Portland, about 2,500 people are classified as homeless, and we believe the number of hidden homeless bumps that number up to about 8,000. And while you're correct that the collapse of the, particularly the residential housing market, has meant a bonanza for first-time homeowners and people that were historically shut out, we have chronic problems at the lower ends of working families, lower-income folks in the Portland community who simply cannot afford, cannot find affordable housing. So we are still building capacity, and we will be building capacity for many years until we meet those needs.
Okay, thank you.
And the one thing I would add to that is that the commercial section of this legislation also addresses a but-for issue, and we're working collaboratively to identify circumstances. But a good example of one is there are large neighborhoods within Multnomah County where there are no grocery stores available to provide fresh produce to the residents. And so one of the things that this potentially would give us a tool to do would be to provide an incentive to bring to these neighborhoods vital community services that would not otherwise be there.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Our next panel is Janet Bird, Jill Sherman, and Denny Brand.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Janet Bird, and I'm here today representing the Housing Alliance, and I can also be quite brief. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of organizations. You'll see on the letterhead that's coming around to you, we're organizations that are statewide in nature, as well as some local organizations, very concerned with housing affordability. And we're here today in support of Senate Bill 322. We believe that Senate Bill 322 would extend a very important tool. It's one of the tools that affordable housing developers and advocates for affordable housing have in their toolbox to go along with a range of other options that we have. We think this is very important. It does create incentives for certain types of development. Chair Kogan talked about the need for services oriented to the community that go along with the affordable housing. We do see a real need for affordable rental housing, particularly in Portland, Multnomah County, but there's evidence that that's true in other parts of the state as well. So we very much encourage you to support this. It's a local option, so you know it's enabling cities and counties to take the step. It's certainly not requiring it. And where you see examples of the City of Portland, Multnomah County coming together, creating these programs, looking closely at guidelines, we think it deserves support. So thank you.
And I see Tigard on here, and Tigard, I take it, takes advantage of this as well.
To my knowledge, only this particular exemption is only used in the City of Portland and Multnomah County and in the City of Eugene.
Okay.
So those are the only jurisdictions that I'm aware that have taken it. Oh, and I'm sorry, City of Gresham.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, members of the Senate Revenue Committee. My name is Jill Sherman, and I'm a vice president with Girding Edlin Development. We're a full-service real estate development company based in Portland, and the types of projects that I tend to focus on are public-private partnerships. I also serve on the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission, though I'm here today with my developer hat on. And I have also been participating in the Big Look Policy Committee and just wanted to acknowledge and thank Chair Kogan and Commissioner Fish for their leadership on that committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 322. Developers can be a key partner to work with the public sector and achieve goals to develop mixed-income housing that leverages the local investment in transit and other urban infrastructure. So in other words, putting this housing next to existing transportation to allow people to live in communities where they have options to getting in their car to be able to access work or have opportunities to walk and bike. We see this as a real tool to help create vibrant neighborhoods where there's a variety of other commercial and neighborhood-serving services present. The limited tax abatement is one of the tools that can help developers in conjunction with the public sector to achieve these types of projects and move us ultimately towards the types of communities we are trying to create where people can get to schools and the store and the doctor's office, either taking a bike or transit or walking, at least have options. I can attest that we have used this program on projects before, and it really can be the difference between a pro forma that meets a threshold that allows you to take it out to the investment and lender community and have it financed and move forward, as opposed to a project that doesn't meet those thresholds and can't move forward. And we are very comfortable and in support of the city's process by which they create thresholds of return and then monitor that so that it's transparent and the public understands that it's not an additional benefit to the developer, but is actually just required to get the project to move forward. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Denny Burrow, and I'm a senior development analyst in the City of Eugene's Planning and Development Department. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 322. The multi-unit property tax exemption is a strategic tool that we use currently to implement the city's smart growth policies by targeting new multi-unit housing in well-defined core areas of our city. In Eugene, this is very challenging because the economics of compact urban growth are very difficult to solve, particularly when trying to steer dense housing into a central downtown area. Despite the fact that there's very strong demand for housing in Eugene, there are offsetting barriers that must be overcome before we see this desirable form of multi-unit housing in our downtown core. Some of the barriers include higher land cost, aging infrastructure, environmental cost, additional costs associated with providing embedded or structured parking, higher construction costs associated with building multiple stories or mixing commercial uses and residential uses. The multi-unit property tax exemption is the primary tool that we use to level the playing field, basically, so that at least we have a chance of attracting some of these housing investments into our targeted areas in our downtown core. Similar to Portland's efforts that were referenced in their testimony, Eugene has also been working hard to be good stewards of this tax exemption program. In 2008, the Eugene City Council adopted public benefit criteria that were used in the project approval process. In addition to having to demonstrate a financial need for the tax exemption, projects also must respond to criteria such as green building features, density, mixed income, accessibility, location, quality building materials, preservation of historic resources, and neighborhood impacts. Eugene is also undergoing a comprehensive Envision Eugene process, which will basically dictate how the city grows over the next 20 years. This multi-unit property tax exemption is one of the major tools that we're talking about using to implement that Envision Eugene growth management program. In addition to Eugene's, in addition to the support for the sunset date, the extension of the sunset date, the proposed clarification regarding the local strategic inclusion of the commercial space used in the definition of public benefit is also supported because it provides the added opportunity to encourage limited commercial uses for targeted projects and targeted areas for projects that we're working on. Finally, at a time when public resources are declining, I think it makes good sense to pause and look at the benefits and the cost of providing this program, this tax exemption program. After the passage of ballot measure 47, property tax limitation in 1996, Eugene placed a moratorium on its multi-unit property tax exemption program with the hopes of that we might capture some of this new tax revenue in the absence of the tax exemption. So for 5 years, we did not accept any applications in the program. During that 5 years, there was no major multi-unit housing built in our boundary. So we concluded that there was clear cause and effect in our program. With very little actual cost associated with this program, we could encourage the development of a housing form that we really wanted to see and grow in Eugene. Today, many of these tax-exempt projects have now come onto the tax roll, so our assumption is most or all of those wouldn't have happened without the tax exemption, so we're benefiting from those projects now. We currently have a few projects in the queue. Two of those are actually in our central downtown core area. They won't start construction before this program sunsets, so we'll need some extension in order to help those projects as long as well. In order to preserve these opportunities and to replicate some of the success that we've had in the past, again, Eugene strongly supports Senate Bill 322 and be happy to answer any questions that you have. Thanks.
Thank you, and thank you for your case study on which kind of responded to Senator Hass's earlier question. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, Marcia Kelly and John Phillips.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly. I'm with the American Association of University Women of Oregon. We are not against the extension of the multi-unit tax credit. The concern that we have, and now after the testimony, we have two concerns now. One on the commercial exemption. Giving the exemption to commercial businesses then puts them at an advantage over other people who are trying to do that same business, whether they be in the next block or 10 blocks away. And so we question why the commercial use needs to be exempted. And hearing the testimony from the city of Portland, the foregone revenue, which is about $4 million, it includes 160 owned units. And I would question what the tax situation is for those owned units in the building, because that, again, puts those people at an advantage over someone who owns their own house and has to pay property taxes. Just a couple of clarifying questions and concerns, because we do want to make sure that we have level playing fields.
Thanks. We may bring the city folks back up to address that, but first of all, let's take Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips with the Department of Revenue, and my comments do not address the policy at all in any way. We don't support or oppose this legislation. I just want to be sure that the committee is going to get on what the legislature does. We'll get what they want. I think the intention is to include commercial properties under certain circumstances where they're approved to be in the design. And I think what we're seeing in the bill is that it doesn't do that. And so actually, there's a statute that says what's exempt, and what it says is exempt is multi-unit housing. And then, but that's not, statute's not included in this bill. So it might be a clarification to explicitly say that commercial property is exempt by actually putting it in the exempt statute. This statute defines multi-unit housing, and it defines it as A, housing, or B, housing. So I think that's really clear to us that the housing could include a design that has commercial, but the law doesn't then say that the commercial is exempt. So I think we'd be happy to help with this, but there's already been litigation over this. There's been a dispute between the county and the city, which they've worked out, and I just hate to see this be passed and attempted to be implemented and there become a problem. So.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? I'm going to bring the city and Jeff still here? Yeah. Bring both of you back to address this. Both issues.
Senator Burdick, they were great questions. If I could tackle the first about whether...
If you could introduce yourself
excuse me,
one more time.
Nick Fish, City Commissioner, City of Portland. Senator Burdick, Vice Chair Morse, the first point that was raised was whether a commercial enterprise that receives an abatement is somehow obtaining an advantage, a commercial advantage over someone that doesn't have... And I want to be clear, when Chair Kogan and I talk about public benefit, we envision using this in situations, let's say in Cully or Outer East Portland, places where we've identified as grocery food deserts, with don't have grocery stores, don't have certain basic services that other parts of the city take for granted, where grocery stores have decided that the barriers, the cost barriers and other risks of coming into these markets is prohibitive. That we might be able to entice them to locate and provide something as essential as food, healthy food to a community, by providing on a limited basis a commercial tax abatement in the building. It works in one of two ways. Either the space is abated, in which case there's a lower cost of entry in what has already been determined by the market to be a risky venture. So you're not technically, a grocery store in a food desert is not competing against anybody. But in other situations, it can work in a slightly different way, which is resourceful developers who have been able to give commercial tax abatements to, like, a grocery store have then had the grocery stores contribute to the overall financing of the project, which has allowed us to keep affordability where we want it. In other words, cross-subsidize the rest of the building on the housing unit side. So I think in concept I understand the concern. But the reality is we're not talking about putting businesses in places that are competing unfairly. We're hoping to introduce businesses to communities that don't currently enjoy the benefits of those businesses.
And what process is used to differentiate one from the other?
Well, the ultimately it has to be subject to the concurrence of two jurisdictions. The City of Portland has to determine a clear public benefit. Multnomah County has to determine... And then the Multnomah County Assessor has to be in concurrence with that as well. So there's ample checks and balances. Neither jurisdiction can act unilaterally in this area.
Right. Yeah, and the only thing I would add to that is, first of all, oh, I'm sorry, Jeff Kogan, Chair of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners.
We're so undisciplined. Chair
you know,
we're not going to be invited back, Senator Burdick. I
want to just apologize. I flub it every time I go to council, so don't feel bad.
It's like a free-for-all by comparison.
Now I forgot what I was going to say. No, so I'm going to say, first of all, this is an exemption. The commercial exemption is one that would have very strict locational limitations. It's not something that would occur broadly anywhere throughout the community. That's something that the city and the county would be working together to identify. But also very broadly, Multnomah County has been cutting its budget 11 years in a row. And so we do not lightly forego revenue of any sort at any time. And we've been working closely with the city of Portland. And I will say that from my board's perspective, making sure there are parameters that are brackets to prevent this from being too broadly used has been a very high priority. And it's one that the city has been very receptive to. And very, very specifically, the only things we want to incent are the but-for situations that were discussed before, and not only just a but-for, in other words, where the development would not happen but for this investment, this incentive, but also where this is a development that meets a public policy goal that the city and the county have mutually agreed on. And that's why the, you know, frankly, the grocery store in the food desert is really the operational definition of the kinds of things we're looking at, something that really serves a public need that would not, the market would not pay for otherwise.
Okay, and then how do owned units fit in the mix here?
Thank you. I'll address that. Kate Allen, City of Portland Housing Policy Manager. It's the third time's a charm. With regard specifically to owned units in multifamily, in the high-density developments, this is also a case of but for. Much of the owned type development has been at the high end. What we want to accomplish, and especially as we go forward with these programs, is the opportunity to include first-time home buyers or home buyers with limited funds in these areas that are highly transit-oriented. They are in job centers. They're helping folks access all of the things that might be affordable on the open market to, you know, a person with plenty of means. So not all of these owned units that we talked about today pass the means test. They all do pass the ownership. So these are not speculative units. These are each year the homeowner must demonstrate that they are residing in the residence. And going forward, as we're looking at this, we're even further tightening up our affordability tests around home ownership so that we're spurring exactly that thing to happen in these sort of communities of opportunity as we've been talking about them.
So you said there's no means test, so...
There is on some of them, and it is property by property. And those 160 units are by far the most of the program has been for rental housing. It often, for all projects, there is some percentage of those units in a building that are affordable, and that's one of the tests that the developer would have to be required to meet. So those are often sprinkled in buildings where there are market rate units, some affordable units in many of them. Similarly, the ownership units that are exempted are also mixed into buildings that have both, you know, high-end units and affordable homeownership units.
So what justification is there for a high-end unit with a, say, a wealthy person living there? What justification is there for giving them tax relief?
So when these programs began, they were not primarily about affordability. They were about location. So folks, believe it or not, the Pearl District was sort of one of the early places where some of these, especially the new multi-unit exemption, when it first came, was incenting the development community to take a chance on providing residential development and some ground floor commercial in an area that was wholly untested. In the subsequent years, the city has increased the requirements around inclusion of affordability. And again, the means test says that if you have this layer cake different financing in any project, a developer will come in and demonstrate that with a tax exemption, a limited term, 10-year tax exemption, they can provide some market rate housing, some affordable housing, and some public benefit. And they couldn't, as Joel Sherman described, they can't quite get there with the tests around the financial feasibility that helps them leverage other private investment. So we make sure that the developer is not overly enriched. The internal rate of return test that all developers have to pass, they cannot exceed, and we monitor on a regular basis that they do not exceed a certain amount of return on the investment of equity that they're making.
So, Mr. Kogan, if it looked like this was turning into some kind of a benefit for high-income people to slip through, you know, one of these exemptions, I take it that the county would be the backstop because that's where the foregone revenue.
Chair Burdick, you're exactly right.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair.
Other questions? Senator Telfer.
On that line, thank you, Madam Chair. So it, with the layer cake and the market rate units, obviously they're going to help bring the cost down, which can be passed on to the affordable units, balancing it. But you take that into account in the on the ROI.
That's correct.
At the end of the day, the total ROI. Okay.
That's correct, Senator.
So it has a dual benefit. It incentivizes people coming down to the area, and it buys down the cost so that those affordable units are, in fact, affordable.
That's correct.
Right. Senator Burdick, if I may, just to close, we will be cutting the ribbon shortly on a new multifamily development in the Pearl District. It's targeting moderate and low-income families. It's called the Ramona. And it is a building where a family of three can get a two-bedroom apartment for about $600, and the most exclusive apartments in the building, which are top floor with three or more bedrooms and killer views, are about $1,000. This is a classic example of a program which benefits from this tax abatement program. We have had a heck of a time creating incentives for family-friendly housing in the Pearl District. Because of the economy, because of the economics of that district. Because of our success, though, in developing this particular project, Portland Public Schools is going to be opening some class space there and providing the first classroom opportunity for children who live in that vicinity. And we will have families, single parents with kids, who are priced out of a lot of neighborhoods in our city, but will be able to live in the Pearl District. That's just an example of one of the benefits of this program. Ramona would not have been built had we not used subsidy in the form of TIF and had we not had an abatement program. And even then, it's very close to the wire. But in Portland, to be able to get a family-friendly apartment for $600 in the central city is quite extraordinary. And we like the idea of having a mix of incomes throughout our city. We do not want to be a city divided by wealth and geography. We want everyone to have the option to live wherever they choose, and that means we have to have tools in our kit that incentivize that kind of housing.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. That concludes our testimony on Senate Bill 322. We will bring this bill back. Oh, I also wanted to, you don't have to come back, but I just wanted to say I think Mr. Phillips brought up some technical issues. Do you want to come back and address this? Sorry, I just forgot.
Yes, thank you, Chair Burdick, Kate Allen, Housing Policy Manager, City of Portland. We will connect with Department of Revenue staff to be sure that the language that accomplishes what we've just described to you today is just right. If that involves an amendment, then we would bring that forward.
Yeah, and I want to express my appreciation for Mr. Phillips for highlighting this. I don't see where he is, but we want to make sure we get it right.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 322, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 297.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 297 is what we have fondly called the Revisers Bill, which is the Legislative Council spends the interim going through the tax statutes and finding those areas where there's technical corrections and needs updating, conforming to existing statutes. So Senate Bill 297 is our 2011 version of that. I think in the last four or five sessions we've introduced it as a committee bill. But the authors of that bill are here from council. Alan Dale and Kate Toswell, who have put in a lot of work, I'm sure, to prepare the bill.
I saw them sitting up there with their thick little briefcases. So why don't you come on up, Kate? I'll have to say, before you get started, I used to be chair of the Judiciary Committee, and this was, the Scrivener's bill was about that thick. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Kate Toswell from the Office of Legislative Counsel. This year's tax revisers bill is Senate Bill 297, and I can walk through that if you would like. The majority of the changes that you see in 297 are actually repeals of income tax credits that are no longer in use. And in particular, I might jump around a little bit throughout the bill, but if you look at Sections 13 and Sections 15, they repeal a number of provisions in Chapter 315, and those are all credits that have already sunset, and in addition, if they have carry-forward provisions, any time that would need to pass to utilize the credit up until the sunset and then use the carry-forward provisions and then provide for time for an amended return has already passed as of now.
So we don't have the tax credits that were covered under House Bill 2067 last session, correct? These are ones that are truly obsolete, that are not up for revision.
Chair Burdick, yes. For example, if you look in Section 13, the fish habitat credit is 315.134. That sunset in 1997. Most of these are from the early 2000s. 315.324 is the reclaimed plastics credit. And for a number of these, we keep them in the ORS because people can continue to claim them, and it provides a reference for people to be able to look in the current book and see them, but they can't claim them for the current tax year. And in fact, for all of these, they haven't been able to claim them since tax years, typically in the early 2000s.
So there's a pollution tax credit that we got rid of a couple, few sessions ago. Is that?
That is fine. Chair Bard, this is finally in this tax revisers bill. It's 315.311, and it sunset in 1999. It did have a significant carry forward, so we continued to print it in the ORS as we compiled after each regular session.
So this will get rid of it forever?
Exactly.
Okay. Good. Editorial
been
comment
losing
there.
Sleep over it, or
you don't know the half of it, Senator Tucker. Okay, continue on, Kate.
So if I go back to the start of the bill, if you look at sections, I believe it's 1, 2, and 3, those actually make changes that conform to the changes that were made in House Bill 2067 last session, when the sunset for the manufactured dwelling credit was moved to 2014. These provisions, these two session law provisions, the one that's in Section 1 and the one that is in Section 3, needed to have their dates moved. They have to do with notice that needs to be provided to residents of manufactured dwelling parks. So without these changes, those sections were, in a sense, meaningless. So just to align these sections with the dates that were changed in 2067, those changes were made. And again, moving to Section 4, that deals with the Advanced Telecommunications Facilities Credit, which is one of the credits that, again, required certification by 2005, and so cannot be used anymore. And so those two sections are being repealed. Those are not in Chapter 315. They're in 285C, dealing with economic development, but it's the same concept where they've remained in the books. We continue to print them, even though the tax years in which they would need to be claimed have elapsed and actually have and are now 5 years in the past. If you look at Section 16 through 19, that's actually slightly more complicated. That deals with the provision for making distributions of revenue and also making provision for refundable credits. It's 316-502. And we realized we had a situation where there were a number of versions of that. In fact, infinite versions were possible because each time we amended one of the refundable credits or certain other provisions of law, we were establishing several versions. And it doesn't actually need to have those versions. And in fact, some of those versions would not take effect until much far out into the future, 2014, 2018, or later. And the potential for error that created, basically our office talked about it, and it seemed that it made sense to have one version that works and doesn't have a number of different provisions. At this point, there are four or five versions that are printed in the ORS, and it creates confusion for the users. And that's 316-502. So that's what that...
Okay, but are you making a policy judgment in that regard? If there are many versions, did you just... choose one? Is this something that we should be making a policy decision on?
Chair Burdick, it's our understanding that all the provisions throughout the bill are non-substantive.
No, and I understand that, but the way you described that, you said you had several versions.
Right, and I believe at the time the additional versions should not have been created because we had a situation where we were removing language that made provided for an appropriation if there is a refundable credit, and it was being shifted depending on when the date of the sunset was. And we had the realization that if that credit, even if the sunset were to, even if the sunset did occur, and you could no longer claim that credit, it would just be meaningless to have. There wouldn't be any appropriation. In other words, we need to have a continuous appropriation language, but it covers anything where you can actually get the refund. And I'm not sure if I'm explaining that exactly clearly, but
like you said, it's complex.
Having each of these different versions led to a situation where there's room for error when we weren't seeing any benefit of having literally five different versions with overlays of different dates.
But it would be clear to someone who studies this and understands it, it would be clear what the intent was, and you just did one approach to...
Absolutely.
To do the intent without picking among policy options.
Actually, to tie this back into this, it's our position that if one of those provisions actually was sunsetted or was changed in a certain way, it would actually make sense to go in later and amend this section rather than establishing numerous light-faced provisions that might take effect somewhere in the future but are not actually necessary to effectuate the intent of the underlying legislation. The next set of provisions are in Section 21, and those deal with the provision for deferral of reinvested gain. And that program required that investments be made on or before December 31st, 1999. Those provisions have remained in the ORS. This, again, my understanding from the department is this is not... Well, you can't use it anymore, and it's also not something where it continues to have effect. So that, in a way, is the closest of these things that would be substantive. But again, no one can take advantage of that program, and the provisions continue to be law. And that's all of the provisions that are listed in Section 21.
Okay. Question, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to think as a practitioner. If somebody was to enter the amnesty program and they went back 5 years, this would not be in the law books anywhere, so they would be unaware of this. Would they be permitted, though, if they went back 5 years to the statute books then and followed the law? They would be able to do this, even though in the blue books right now, it wouldn't be there. You see what I'm saying?
Senator Telford, Chair Burdick, the law continues to be as it was applicable to that tax year. So that hasn't changed.
You've got to go find the old volumes.
You have to look at the old volumes. By repealing it now, it doesn't affect what happened for those tax years. And, in fact, we keep it in the volumes so that people can see it. But it doesn't give them any benefit for tax years to which it does not apply.
So for clarification, what I'm saying is that if I were to today, it's not law, assuming this all passes, and therefore it wouldn't be law, and yet I'm doing my tax return for 5 years ago, I'm to use the law 5 years ago and not as it's written today. But I would be unaware of those things unless I went back and used old statute books, which we do anyway. So.
Yeah, so what this does is it just takes a key away. I mean, it takes a prompt away. You have to actually look it up as to how it was then, because even though it drags along in the statute, eventually you get rid of it. But practically speaking, and because that's really a good question, Senator Telford, practically speaking, someone, let's say 5 years, in most cases, do these repeals go like even earlier than apply even earlier than 5 years, or farther away than 5 years? I'm not phrasing this question very well. What I'm saying is, in a practical sense, would someone who's trying to figure out what they should have done 5 years ago still find a prompt in the statute?
Chair Burdick, what I have tried to do, what I have done, is gone through and accounted for the carry forwards and also accounted for amended returns, and where there is a language that maybe there's some sort of, you know, it allows for something extra, we've erred on the side of leaving it till the next session. And in fact, there are notes that we keep. And for the most part, they're clear. There's a certain date, it sunsets, and there's a carry forward for 3 years or 5 years or what have you, and then allowing for amended returns, you get to a date that's already in the past as of this moment and as of this tax year.
The only difference is that with an amended return, you know you have to go back to prior law. If I've never filed a return, but I want to enter into the tax amnesty program, assume we sometime do it again.
It's,
it was so successful. I know, but I use it as an example. They would be unaware of it because it isn't that the statutes don't necessarily say this paragraph has been amended in 2011 by something else. I mean, so there isn't that trigger that tells you that this has been amended, so I need to go back and look at what the law was 5 years ago.
Senator Telford, Chair Burdick, excuse me. There actually is, if you knew what the section was, there are still source notes telling you when it was repealed and that it was repealed, but that is assuming that you knew of the existence of that particular incentive. If you didn't, it would be, I mean, I think there is enough time going back that you would be able to isolate that, but there is a certain cutoff, and we go through and we look so that we don't continue to have ORS sections that nobody can use, and people continue to ask about these sections. They think that they're law. They don't realize that the reclaimed plastics credit hasn't been available for 10 years and that they can't use it because it's sitting in the books.
Okay, now the real question of the day. We do all these things. How many pages do we reduce from these big volumes of ORS?
I would say, Chair Burdick, probably they're just individual section numbers, but I think we actually do save some pages, not enough to reduce by a volume. We just keep adding volumes.
I wish I'd had this the other night.
Adding pages the rest of the section.
Yes, correct. I wish I'd had this the other night because I got a question while I was on a panel. Please give an example of a statute you'd like to get rid of as opposed to a statute you'd like to pass. And I wish I'd had this in front of me at the time.
I would add one other point, which is in this bill we also did some cleanup of some provisions that were added in duplicate in the 2007 session, and they had to do with diesel engines, a tax credit for certain types of diesel engines, and also for manufactured dwelling closures. And there were identical provisions of law that were passed in separate bills by separate, that came out of separate committees in the 2007 session. And we've been able to go through and unravel what has happened there and do a cleanup. And that will actually make for a lot more readability in the ORS.
As a matter of course, session by session, where you reconciled bills during the session. Is this one that just leaked through?
Chair Burdick, with these provisions, they were so elaborate, and they also had internal references within each of the bills, so we were not able to do that in the editorial process. And it actually took a fair amount of effort to untangle it and to be able to do it in this bill. So we spent a lot of the time this past interim doing that, and so that we have achieved in this bill.
Okay. Other questions? Where's Sarah Moscow? Okay, thank you very much. Doesn't look like there's any other questions, and I don't think we have any other witnesses. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 297, but I'm going to hang on to it for a couple of days.
Yeah,
just
we don't
to
have
let
fiscal.
Oh, we don't have fiscal anyway, so I've got no choice. Okay, now our last item here is work session on Senate Bill 305. I'm looking for my agenda here. Oh, here we go. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 305.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 305, you heard about 2 weeks ago, and it involves the amnesty program and the installment payments. And the intent was to provide some relief for individuals in the installment program that were in danger of getting behind on their payments. Right now, the amnesty program is generated in balances, but at the end of the calendar year, $47 million. There was that $12 million extra that's in the program change bill at Ways and Means as part of the rebalancing. That's part of the $47 million. Above that, there's $6.3 million in outstanding installment payments. None of that's been committed for any budgetary purposes. What this bill does is gives the Department of Revenue some flexibility in cases where people are getting behind on those payments. The original bill moved back the date from May 31st, which was a hard date in the original amnesty bill to make sure the dollars came in the current biennium, move that back to November 30th, your Dash 1 amendment deletes that. It keeps the May 31 date and then keeps the language that was in the last section of the bill or sub E of Section 1 that says, for good cause shown, the department may extend beyond May 31st the time for a taxpayer to make payments under an installment payment. So it gives the department, for good cause, flexibility, which wasn't which is not in current law.
So we gave him a solid extension of the deadline, and then if circumstances warrant, they can go a little bit.
Yeah.
More.
Well, actually, Madam Chair, what the amendment does is
keeps
the deadline the
yeah.
same. And our concern about that was we would end up pushing revenue in the next biennium. Through the amendment, you give the department discretion to do that, but don't actually push everything out in the next biennium. I did a revenue impact statement on it. I put it as a small positive, probably not measurable, but under the presumption that some people that would not be able to pay would use that additional 6 months to be able to pay. Now, you could argue down the road, maybe people that, you know, that you cut off and say, okay, you got to go back as a regular taxpayer, you have to pay penalty and interest, you know, because you lost your chance, maybe you'd get some revenue from those somewhere down the road. But I think the more concrete assumption is that you'd have probably a small revenue impact in the first 6 months and next biennium, because people, through that extension, would be able to meet the commitment that they've made that they can't meet right now.
Yeah, and this keeps the pressure on and certainly seems fair to the people who actually did comply, but it shows that we do have a heart.
Well, and I'm not sure we all foresaw the extreme economic difficulty when we entered, when we started the tax amnesty program. And so I think some people just got caught up in that, and their intentions were good in coming back into the system. And I don't have a problem with giving them benefit of the doubt and giving them more time to pay.
Right. And I would hope the Department of Revenue would use this wisely and compassionately.
And I will add, Madam Chair, somewhat embarrassingly, that this $47 million is about triple what I had assumed the revenue impact.
That's
so,
okay.
We love the revenue came in quite a bit more than we had.
We love mistakes in that direction, Dr. Warner.
Dr. Warner, there was an excellent advertising campaign, too, that I don't think you took into consideration.
That must have been that.
Guess who's going to have to carry the bill now? Okay.
Have you voted, Madam Chair?
No, we have not.
Okay.
But we do have a Dash 1 amendment, Senator Morris, since you walked in at just the right time, to Senate Bill 305.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 305, dated 2-18-11.
Senator Morris has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 305. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris? We have all the paperwork.
Okay, everything's intact. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 305 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 305 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. I am going to have Senator Hass carry this. He's so enthusiastic. Okay, maybe that completes our business for the day. And Paul, any
part of that? Excuse me, Madam Chair, did you move?
We did not.
You did not.
We don't have the paperwork.
Okay.
And we also, I want to take a little time to go over some of the details. It's kind of complicated. Okay, any other matters before the committee? We are adjourned.